improvements become as important to her as to him. He told her, "If Marshall gets paid, you get a $2,000 bonus." Within 12 months, she collected her bonus. "I've never thought of this or seen it done before, but you can be sure that I'm mentioning it to all future clients. You can monetize the punishment and the problem, or you can monetize the result and create a solution. Either way, it works." Rule 8. The best time to change is now. As I've written, of the tens of thousands of business people who have come to my lectures and classes, only 70% ever followed through on what they learned and actually did something about it. I am not ashamed of this fact, which means a 30% non-compliance rate. Actually, I'm proud of my non-compliance rate and amazed it isn't much higher. If you've gotten this far in this book, I am sure you believe that you will do at least something, if only one simple thing, that is advised herein. For example, how tough can it be to stop punishing the messenger? But I'm resigned to the fact that while many readers will do this, many will not. We have interviewed hundreds of people who have participated in our training programs 1 year later. We ask the people who did nothing why they did not live up to the commitments that they made after they attended the leadership training. As far as we can tell, most people who do nothing are no worse as human beings than the people who change. They are no less intelligent. They have about the same values. Then, why don't they do what they committed to? The answer can be found in a dream. It's a dream I have often, and you may too. It goes something like this. "You know, I am incredibly busy right now. In fact, I feel about as busy today as I have ever felt. Some days I feel overcommitted. In fact, every now and then, my life feels out of control. But we are working on some unique and special challenges right now. I feel like the worst of this is going to be over in a couple or 3 months. After that, I am going to take a couple of weeks, take a little time off, get organized, spend some time with the family, and start working out. Everything is going to change. This time will be here soon. After that, it won't be crazy anymore." Have you ever had a dream that sounds vaguely like this? How long have you been dreaming this dream? How's that working for you? Perhaps it's time to stop dreaming of a time when you won't be busy, because the time will never come. It's your dream, but it's also a mirage. I have learned a hard lesson trying to help real people change real behavior in the real world. There is no couple of weeks. Look at the trend line. Sanity does not prevail. There is a good chance that tomorrow is going to be just as crazy as today. If you want to change anything about yourself, the best time to start is now. Ask yourself, what am I willing to change now? Just do that. That's more than enough for now. Chapter 14. Special Challenges for People in Charge. Memo to Staff. How to Handle Me. For years, one of the most popular talk radio programs in the U.S. has been Imus in the Morning with Don Imus. The daily program is a curious mix of current events, satirical songs, rants by Imus, interruptions by his staff, and interviews with call-in guests who range from powerful politicians to network anchors, to authors promoting their books, to ordinary citizens. Imus's only rule for guests is, you cannot be boring. Imus's on-air persona, which may or may not be real, is that of a curmudgeon. He's always mad about something, whether it's government hypocrisy or the air quality in the studio. You can't tell if Imus is liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, hardline on moral issues or soft, nor can you predict how he will treat his guests. He's an equal opportunity offender. Sometimes he's polite and deferential, other times rude, calling people morons and weasels and liars while they're on the air. The one thing you can be sure of listening to Imus is that at some point, you will get upset. Imus gets away with this antisocial behavior because every once in a while, he explains to the audience what he's up to. "The only thing you have to understand about this show," he says, "is that everything I say is jive. You cannot take it serious. You know I'm serious when I say the following 6 words. You have to stop that now. Everything else is jive." It's a little like the Surgeon General's warning on a cigarette pack, and brilliant. In effect, He's instructing the audience on how to deal with him. Perhaps as a result, Imus in the Morning is consistently one of the highest-rated shows in its highly competitive time slot. It's a technique every boss should learn. Wouldn't it be great if all bosses came with similar product warnings? Wouldn't it be even better if, like Imus, they were sufficiently self-possessed that they could write the warnings themselves? Imagine a workplace where the boss tells you, "Listen, I like to punish the messenger, so be very careful when you're bringing me bad news. I'll probably bite your head off, even though I know it's not your fault." Or, "No matter how terrific your idea or how thoroughly you've thought it out, I'm going to add my 2 cents to it in order to improve it. Your first impulse will be to listen to me and act on my suggestion. Please don't. Just nod your head and pretend you're listening. If you're as smart as I thought you were when I hired you, you'll ignore me and do it your way." A lot of bosses are already doing some variation on this with their employees. I know one self-made man who has a volcanic temper. He doesn't fly off the handle too often, but he leads a very busy schedule, starting at 4 a.m. with dictation to his secretary, phone calls to distant time zones, and not one, but 2 breakfast meetings. By the time the rest of us begin our workday, he's already had a full day, and begun another one. As a result, he's chronically tired, which means he's chronically testy. The slightest annoyance can set him off. The good news is that he knows this about himself. He's not putting on a show like a baseball manager throwing a fake hissy fit over an umpire's bad call. He's genuinely mad. But the rage dies down as quickly as it erupted. To him, the tantrum acts as a release valve. I've seen him when he's lost it, and it's not a pretty picture. Employees have been known to burst into tears during one of his tirades. To his credit, he regains his composure instantly and always tells his staff, "I'm not mad at you. I'm just mad. And now it's over and forgotten. I'm sorry you had to be here to witness it." A little bit of this is phony. He probably is angry at something a staffer has done. But he's smart enough to let them know that he's behaving like a jerk, and they ought to ignore it. This sort of candor is admirable, because it features a boss trying to get better at admitting to a managerial shortcoming, telling his colleagues, and helping them deal with it. If I were his coach, I'd also have him soliciting suggestions, i.e. feed forward, from his staff on how he could correct this shortcoming. But let's take it one step at a time. Some years ago, I worked with a public relations executive who was having a hard time hanging on to personal assistants. He'd hire perfect candidates, but they'd quit 6 or 7 months on the job. I wasn't able to track down this bevy of former assistants to get their feedback on why they left, so I tried an experiment. I asked the executive to imagine the feedback I would have gotten from his departed assistants. What would they say good and bad about him? Then I asked him to write it down as if it were a memo to his next prospective assistant titled, "How to Handle Me." Here's what he wrote. "I'm good with people, and even better with ideas. If clients have a problem, it's my job to come up with a creative solution. I'm bad at everything else. I hate paperwork. I find it hard to perform the usual courtesies that clients expect of a personal services business. I don't follow up with thank you notes. I don't remember birthdays. I dread picking up the phone because it's always someone with a problem, never someone calling to say that a huge check is on its way to me or that I've won the lottery. You need to know this about me. I have a pretty good idea how the business is doing, but I don't like budgets and expense reports and projections. People think I'm an unmade bed as a manager, and they're right. I'm not bragging or being self-deprecating. It's the truth. On the personal side, I'm a decent, polite human being. I'll never yell at you. When things are going well and we've pulled off a few miracles in a row, I begin to think I'm one of the funniest, most charming people on earth. You may find my humor caustic at these times. Please don't take it personally. Better yet, tell me I'm out of line. I have a relaxed, laissez-faire personality, and the more hectic things get, the calmer I get. That's my peculiar reflex to pressure. Don't misinterpret this cool demeanor to mean that I don't care. I care a lot. I only expect one thing of you. I want you to do as much of my job as you can handle. The less I have to do, the better. Do that, and we will succeed magnificently together." He handed this document to his new assistant, a bubbly graduate fresh out of the University of Michigan named Michelle, on her first day at work. When I saw him again about 18 months later, I was dying to know if he was making progress with his so-called assistant retention issues. "Are things working out with Michelle?" I asked. "Oh yes," he said. "How can you tell?" I asked, ever the skeptic. "Because last Christmas, every client sent her, not me, a lavish fruit basket or bottle of champagne to thank her. When I told her that I wanted an assistant to do my job for me, she took it to heart. Apparently, she's been shielding me from almost every problem that comes across her desk and solving it herself. That wouldn't have happened if I hadn't told her how to handle me." What's interesting and reassuring about this story is that it's an example of a boss accurately assessing his shortcomings and his employee agreeing with him. This isn't always the case. Sometimes the gap between what a boss says about himself and what the staff believes is wide, very wide. The most obvious disconnect is when the staff concludes that the boss's opinion of how he wants to be handled is either fantasy or wishful thinking. I saw this some years ago with the division chief who prided himself on his fairness and the fact that he didn't play favorites. He never wrote it down in a how-to-handle-me memo to his staff, but he was always warning employees that he didn't like yes-men and suck-ups, that you earned your way onto his first team purely on performance. Unfortunately, his staff considered this self-assessment to be about 180 degrees removed from the truth. The man was a sucker for sycophants. He hated to be challenged, and he habitually rewarded those who agreed with him at the expense of those who did not. What should have been an opportunity to bring boss and employees in sync actually became a toxic joke that divided both sides further. The other disconnect is more subtle. It occurs when the boss's self-assessment is accurate, but irrelevant. I saw this with the CEO of an energy company who was famous for being a stickler for details, even to the point of correcting people's grammar and punctuation in memos and letters. He had been an English teacher who had switched to corporate law, where his attention to detail made him a great success. The energy company had been a client, and when he skillfully guided the company out of bankruptcy, again in part because of his fanatic attention to detail, the board appointed him CEO. That's when the trouble began. He never wrote a how-to-handle-me memo. The idea had yet to occur to me. But then again, he didn't have to. Every time he took a red pencil to one of his senior staff's writings, he was sending an unmistakable signal that this matters to me. Word spread quickly through the executive ranks that if you wanted to make a favorable impression on the new CEO, all you had to do was write memos with perfect grammar and punctuation. If he didn't change his ways, he would either have a mutiny on his hands or an executive suite filled with gifted grammarians. That's when I was called in. You can imagine the problem. The boss was sending a signal on what he expected from his executives, and it had the added virtue of being true. But the executives thought it was silly, that this was no way to run a company or judge executive talent. I went over his staff's feedback. The first comment was, $5 million a year is a lot to pay for an editor. Second comment, put away the red pencil. Third comment, this is no longer first grade, and so on. It took me months to make the CEO accept that correcting grammar and internal memoranda was a poor and humiliating use of his time. What mattered to him did not matter to the troops. That was a dangerous disconnect that neither he nor the company could afford. I mention this because writing a memo to staff on how to handle me is not only an admirable exercise in self-examination, but a surefire method for stimulating dialogue with the troops. But be careful. Your memo has to be brutally honest. Your employees have to believe it is accurate. And most important, they must believe it matters. Anything less on all three counts, and you may as well keep your instructions to yourself. Stop letting your staff overwhelm you. One of the great pleasures of being the boss, any kind of boss, whether you're running a three-person staff or division of 30,000 employees, is that you get to call the shots, all the shots. Meetings begin when you say they begin. They take place where you want them to take place. They end when you say they're over. Whether you're a great boss or a bad one, you answer to no one who's under your charge. They all answer to you. There's a dangerous underside to this, which eludes many bosses once they get inside their comfortable cocoon of all-powerfulness. As a boss, you alone know how much you depend on your people. Without their loyalty and support, you are nothing. You know this, and if you're a wise leader, you remind your people repeatedly that you know how much you need them. But you should never forget that it's a two-way street. Just as you are dependent on your staffers, they're dependent on you, in ways that may have nothing to do with on-the-job performance. They crave your attention, your approval, your affection. If you've got any sort of charisma as a leader, they literally gauge their status in an organization by how much FaceTime they get with you. There's nothing wrong with this. What better way for the troops to develop than by getting FaceTime with their leaders so they can observe and then emulate their behavior? But this codependency can develop into trouble. I know the editor-in-chief of one of the top women's magazines. An incredibly well-organized woman, she took pride in her ability to juggle her high-pressure job and still maintain a sane home life with her husband and two young kids. She was pretty close to being a perfect boss. Fair, egalitarian, kept her door open to everyone. She was even fair to people after she fired them, always helping them land new jobs. The payoff for perfection, however, was not what she expected. As a dedicated have-it-all mom, she tried to be home by 6:30 each night to be with her children. Over time, she noticed that she was making more and more excuses for working late, to the point that within 2 years, she was regularly at her desk until 9:30 or 10 p.m. At first, she thought it was simply because she loved her job. Running a glamorous money-making magazine can be a ton of fun. But as she analyzed the problem, she realized it had nothing to do with her. Her staff depended on her too much. A lot of it could be blamed on her openness and availability. She had created an environment where it was easy to get FaceTime with the boss, so everyone naturally wanted FaceTime. Of course, this put her in a never-ending upward spiral where she could never leave the office. People were always coming into her at the end of the day saying, "I need 10 minutes of your time." Being the perfect boss, she would give it to them. Paradoxically, she was losing control because she was in control. To regain control, she gathered her staff and announced, "From now on, my door is closed after 5:45. After that, it's get out of my FaceTime. Only my kids get FaceTime." That only solved half her problem. She got home by 6:30 every night, but her staff felt lost and abandoned. That's when I got involved. Making the staff less dependent on her, I said, was a good thing, but they still need leadership. They still needed to be redirected. I had her arrange discussions with each of her direct reports to discuss two things. One, I wanted her to ask each of them, "Let's look at your responsibilities. Are there areas where you think I need to be more involved and less involved?" She was making them define the areas where they could legitimately ask for FaceTime with her and areas where it was not legitimate. In effect, she was delegating more responsibility to them, but in a generous and empowering way. She was allowing them to determine how much responsibility they could take. Two, I wanted her to say, "Now, let's look at my job. Do you ever see me doing things that a person at my level shouldn't be doing, such as getting involved in details that are too minor to worry about?" She was forcing them to come up with ideas for how she could become more disengaged. In effect, she was letting them help her get home by 6:30. What better gift can a leader present to his or her troops? And vice versa. I didn't have to remind her to say thank you. Remember this the next time you find yourself trapped by a needy, demanding staff. If they need too much of your time, you can't just tell them to stop bothering you. You have to wean them away and make it seem like it's their idea. Let them figure out what they should be doing on their own. Let them tell you where you're not needed. There's a fine line between legitimate FaceTime and get out of my FaceTime. It's up to you as a boss to make the troops face that. Stop acting as if you are managing you. Telling staff how to handle the boss is admirable, but it doesn't completely solve one of the great unappreciated ironies of the boss versus bossed dynamic. It is this. A lot of managers assume that their staff should be exactly like them, in behavior, in enthusiasm, in intelligence, and most especially, in how they apply that brain power. You can't blame them. If I were a super successful boss, I'd be inclined to populate my organization with clones of me. What better way to ensure that everything gets done my way? This, by the way, is a perfectly natural inclination. Given the choice, we all favor hiring people who closely resemble the person we see in the mirror every day. At the same time, we're also smart enough to know that an organization stocked with clones marching in lockstep doesn't create diversity in an organization. You need different voices, different mindsets, different personality mixes. In my experience, it's the odd out-of-left-field dissenting voices, the ones challenging groupthink and the status quo, that make an organization hum and thrive. Also, a staff of clones does not guarantee fluid teamwork. For example, if I were Michael Jordan starting a basketball team from scratch, I'd be glad to have one player like me, but I'd still need two or three taller, stronger players to man the front line, and a smaller, lightning-quick player to feed me the ball. A basketball squad of five Michael Jordans, intriguing as it sounds, is surely a recipe for dysfunction. Most bosses are smart enough to know this, and therefore resist the temptation to hire only mirror images of themselves. But that doesn't mean the message sinks in completely. Sometimes I have to remind even the most sensitive tuned-in bosses, you are not managing you. This hit me when I began working with the CEO of a large service company. Let's call him Steve. Steve prided himself on being a great leader who lived the values he encouraged all his employees to follow. In fact, he considered himself the role model for his company's leadership values. As with all my clients, I let Steve know what all of his coworkers thought of him. While they were generally ecstatic that Steve was the CEO, they were in general agreement that he stifled the flow of open communication. In this one area, his behavior was inconsistent with his message. He was not practicing what he was preaching. A simple problem, I thought, easily solved if Steve is willing to change. I would get him to listen more and ask people for input. I would tell him that he cannot end any meeting without asking everyone present if they felt like they had a fair hearing of their views. If he did this consistently over 12 months or so, the no-dialogue rap would fade away. It wasn't that simple. As I studied the feedback from Steve's staff, something didn't add up. On the one hand, the feedback said he killed open discussion. On the other hand, it said he was always changing his mind. That was confusing, because people who kill open discussion are not usually people who are always changing their mind. The two flaws tend to be mutually exclusive. To make the situation more perplexing, when I talked to Steve, he practically laughed at the feedback. "I may have a lot of issues," he said, "but killing dialogue is not one of them. I'm always talking things out with my people." I recalled interviewing one of Steve's directors who said, "You have to understand, this fellow is the world champion at arguing with himself. He was a star debater in college." Now the feedback made sense. Time and time again, an employee would come to Steve with an idea. Being a debate champion, Steve's first reaction was to go into debate mode and shoot holes in the idea. The employee's reaction, as a direct report, was to shut down in the face of the verbal onslaught from the boss. Two people, two different perspectives. Steve thought he was having an open debate. The employee thought that he had just been blown away. Steve compounded the problem by debating with himself as well. Someone would say, "Why don't we try this?" and Steve would approve. He inspired his whole staff to get behind the suggestion. But a few days later, after he had enough time to debate his decision strenuously with himself, he'd change his mind, saying, "Maybe that wasn't such a good idea." In his head, he was being open-minded. In his staff's collective brain, he was confusing them. Let's not get into the fact that you can't do that in a leadership position. You can't motivate 200 people to conquer a hill, and when they all start charging, say, "Wait a minute, maybe this isn't such a smart plan." Do that a few times, and no one's going to be inspired to take hills for you. They will just sit there and wait. Let's focus on making Steve see the problem, which I like to call the golden rule fallacy. You see it in situations where the boss makes the logical inference that the people being bossed are just like him, and in strict obedience to the golden rule, like to be treated the same way that the boss likes to be treated. "I like it when people treat me this way, therefore I will treat everyone else this way." When I pointed out to Steve that he liked heated debate because it played to his strengths, he agreed. "I like it when people do that for me, mix it up and argue." That's nice, but they aren't you, I said. What's wrong with it? He asked. What's wrong with me expressing an opinion, and someone else expressing an opinion, and we have a healthy debate? I love that. I said, well, yes, but you are the boss, and they aren't. You were the star debater at college, and they weren't. This isn't a fair fight. All you're doing to them is saying, you lose, I win. Their odds of beating you at this game are zero, so they opt not to play. That's not true, he countered. I have someone on staff who loves it as much as I do. That's the problem, I said. Sometimes your debating style works, particularly with people who enjoy arguing both sides of every issue and don't back down from the verbal jousting. If everyone on your staff was like this one person, you wouldn't have a problem. Unfortunately, 99% of your team is not like that guy. Your one success is not being replicated with anyone else. Why? Because that single exceptional employee is just like you, but you are not managing you. True to form, Steve, the debating champion, had lured me into a heated debate. Luckily, the "you're not managing you" line hit home. Suddenly, he got it. He saw that he was operating under a bogus assumption that what was good for him was good for everyone else. From that moment on, Steve's improvement was a sure thing. He paid close attention to his debating urges and stifled them when they put his staff at a huge disadvantage. He apologized to everyone for the mistakes in his past and promised to do better in the future. He routinely invited people to voice their opinions in meetings and thought once, twice, three times before challenging them. Nothing wrong with challenging people. His goal was to open up the dialogue, not become a doormat for every silly opinion. He followed up with people, reminding them that he was trying to improve in this area. Lastly, he asked them for suggestions that could help him get even better. It didn't happen overnight. These transformations require time to take hold with the people assessing you. As I say, you have to change 100% to get 10% credit for it. So after 18 months, Steve was perceived as a better boss. He was the same guy in most ways. He still loved to argue with himself and anyone else in the room. The only difference? He now accommodated the fact that his staffers didn't necessarily feel the same way as he did. Since my session with Steve, I've been more alert to this "it's not a fair fight" dynamic between bosses and the boss. A friend once told me about her boss and his obsession with documentation. He had been trained as a lawyer, someone who was slavishly devoted to evidence and paperwork and perfectly maintained files. When he started his marketing consulting business, he did not abandon his fondness for paper. He still saved everything. This was fine, except he expected everyone else to be as obsessed with retaining documents as he was. He would call meetings, during which everyone knew he would haul out some ancient letters and memos as evidence to chastise someone for letting things fall through the cracks. I interpreted this behavior as typically wrong-headed management, classic golden rule fallacy at work. The great entrepreneur overlooked the fact that as owner of the company, he had access to any and all documents, whereas his subordinates did not. He did not appreciate that he was instigating a fight that only he could win. He loved documents and documentation, and wrongly assumed everyone else did too. See it once, and you begin to see it everywhere. By all means, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But realize that it doesn't apply in all instances in management. If you manage your people the way you'd want to be managed, you're forgetting one thing. You're not managing you. Stop checking the box. I was meeting with the chief executive recently, listening to him express puzzlement that his employees did not understand the company's mission and overall direction. I don't get it, he said. I've spelled it out for them in meetings. I've summarized it in a memo. See, here's the memo. It's very clear. What more do the employees want? For a moment there, I thought he was kidding, that he had a very refined sense of irony. Making people understand the company's mission and vision doesn't happen by fiat or by memo. It also doesn't happen overnight. Surely this smart CEO knew that. By the pained expression on his face, I could tell he was dead serious and, if only in this one area of management, clueless. Let's review the situation, I said. How was this memo distributed? By email, he said. It went to everyone in the company. Okay, I said. But my hunch is that the method of distribution is all you know about this. How many people actually opened the email and read the memo? I don't know, he said. Of those, how many do you think understood the memo? I have no idea, he said. Of those who understood it, how many believed it? He shook his head. Of this dwindling group of believers, how many remembered it? Another sorry headshake. That's a lot of unknowns for something you regard as vital to your company's existence, I said. But that's not the worst part. Once you eliminate all the people who either didn't receive, or read, or understand, or believe, or remember the memo, and it's quite possible there's no one left, how many people do you think will adopt the memo's contents? How many will begin living and breathing the company's mission because of your memo? I think I heard the CEO mutter a contrite, I don't know. But it was hard to tell, because by now his voice was nearly inaudible. It's not my mission in life to deflate or depress clients, so I tried to revive his spirits by changing the subject, by pointing out that the problem was him, not his memo. The only thing you're guilty of, I said, was checking the box. Huh? He said. You thought your job was done when you articulated the mission and wrote the memo, as if it were one more item on your to-do list for the day. You checked the box, and you moved on. Next. I could see the scales slowly lifting from his eyes, so I pressed on with my theory about what may be the most egregious source of corporate dysfunction, the failure of managers to see the enormous disconnect between understanding and doing. Most leadership development revolves around one huge false assumption, that if people understand, then they will do. That's not true. Most of us understand, we just don't do. As I said in Chapter 11, we all understand that being grossly overweight is bad for our health, but not all of us actually do anything to change our condition. This CEO is no different from most executives who believe their organizations operate with strict down-the-chain-of-command efficiency. The boss says jump, the subordinates ask, how high? In a perfect world, every command is not only obeyed, but obeyed precisely and promptly, almost as if it were a fait accompli. The boss doesn't have to follow up ever, because he said it and it was done. After all, he checked the box. I'm not sure why bosses persist in thinking this way. Maybe their ego can't fathom that their orders might not be strictly followed. Maybe they're too lazy to investigate whether people did their bidding. Maybe they're too disorganized to adhere to strict follow-up procedures. Maybe they think that following up is beneath them. Whatever the reason, they blindly assume that if people understand, they will do. The good news here for every manager, including my CEO client, is that this false belief has a simple cure. It's called follow-up. Once you send out a message, you ask people the next day if they heard it. Then you ask if they understood it. Then, a few days later, you ask if they did something about it. Believe me, if the first follow-up question doesn't get their attention, the next one will. And so will the final one. Stop being prejudiced about your employees. I spend most of my professional life trying to change people's behaviors in the workplace. I tell people that change is a simple equation. Stop the annoying behavior, and you'll stop being perceived as an annoyance. It's so easy, I'm amazed I get paid to teach it. I wish I could say the same about changing the way people think. But lately, that's become a critical part of my practice too. The big reason for it is that there's been a radical shift in the way employees regard their roles in and their relationships to an organization. The magazine, Fast Company, nailed it in 1998 when it ran a notorious cover story titled Free Agent Nation. It posited the then radical notion that the organization man was dead, that the best performers in a company were no longer interested in sacrificing their lives for the good of the organization. The smart ones believed that their corporation would drop them in a flash when they no longer met the company's needs. So they in turn were willing to drop the company when it no longer met their needs. Free agency meant that each employee was operating like a small self-contained business rather than a cog in the wheel of a large system. It took a while for this free agent virus to spread, but trust me, it's an epidemic now. A sweeping pathology that demands a change in the way bosses think. The first thing I do with managers who are overwhelmed or confused by this workplace shift is make them see that they are prejudiced about their employees. This always gets their attention. Me? Prejudiced? Get out of here. But if prejudice means harboring inflexible, intolerant beliefs about a group of people that do not coincide with reality or how that group sees itself, it's true. Managers who are blind to the changes in this new cohort of free agents are operating like dangerous, deluded executive bigots. It's no different than a manager refusing to hire a young married woman because he believes she will leave her job eventually to have babies and, therefore, is not serious about her career. It's easy to forget that there was a time not too long ago when almost everyone thought this way. The prejudice against free agents takes many forms, but here are four that any of us can easily fall into. 1. I know what they want. This is the biggest prejudice, and the easiest to understand. Almost every economic model has historically assumed that money is the key motivator for any employee. And so bosses assume that if they pay their people top dollar, they will get performance and loyalty in return. Sorry, it doesn't work that way anymore. There's no denying that money matters in everyone's career calculus. But at some point, the top performers achieve a level of financial comfort, however tenuous, when other considerations begin to dominate. As economist Lester Thoreau pointed out in Building Wealth, free agents must wrestle with the paradox that the economic value of their experience falls rather than rises in the course of a career. The shelf life of knowledge, especially technical knowledge, is continuously shrinking. And so, free agents respond by moving on to new challenges that enhance their knowledge and let them outpace the shrinking value of their experience, and in turn, reward them with more satisfaction and quite possibly more money. If you've ever been puzzled by a talented employee who left you to work at another company in a different job for less money, blame it on this prejudice. This prejudice, carelessly or ruthlessly applied, can actually drive good people away. I remember a multimillionaire entrepreneur telling me in amazement about a well-paid writer on his staff who could never meet a deadline. The entrepreneur liked the writer, but wanted to change his cavalier attitude toward deadlines. So he instituted a seemingly simple carrot-and-stick scheme. Every time the writer made his monthly deadline, he'd get a $500 bonus. To no effect. The writer still missed his deadlines. Apparently, he was making enough money so that an additional $500 a month didn't make that much difference to him. It was no different when the entrepreneur increased the bonus to $3,000. Still no improvement. Only when the boss resorted to deducting $3,000 from the writer's paycheck did he change his ways. Economists would call this loss aversion, the phenomenon that we hate losing something more than we enjoy gaining its equivalent. I would call this prejudice, a failure to understand what motivates an employee. The writer did indeed meet his deadlines for a few months, but he left the company within 6 months. Apparently, although the writer didn't care about the rewards for good performance, he felt strongly about being punished for poor performance. The bonus didn't motivate him. The deduction, though, insulted him. The entrepreneur figured out how to change his employee's behavior, but he also drove him away. They're a complicated lot, these free agents, and if you think you know what makes them tick, you first need to check your prejudices at the door. This "I know what they want" delusion extends far beyond money. As a general rule, people in their 20s want to learn on the job. In their 30s, they want to advance. And in their 40s, they want to rule. No matter what their age, though, understanding their desires is like trying to pin down Mercury. You have to find out what they want at every step by literally asking them. And you can't assume that one size fits all. The person who sees the noble goal of work-life balance as irrelevant at age 24 may find it critical at 34. Consider the still young career of shortstop Alex Rodriguez. At age 20, he won a batting title with the Seattle Mariners. 4 years later, he moved to the Texas Rangers for the staggering salary of $25 million a year, where he was the American League MVP and three-time home run champion. 4 years later, at the tender age of 28, he moved to the New York Yankees. He was, by general consensus, the best player in the game, and yet two teams let him go. Actually, the organization didn't let him go. He left the organization. The first time for more money, the second time for a shot at the World Series with the perennial front-running Yankees. This is classic free agent nation in action, in large part because baseball invented free agency in 1975 after a legal battle that let players move freely among the teams. It's an example of A, the employee calling the shots, B, the employee using the organization to fulfill his needs, and C, those needs changing over time. As far as the entrepreneur and the writer above, I don't know what I would have done, other than to ensure the entrepreneur that the traditional carrot-and-stick approach doesn't work anymore. Clearly, dangling the carrot of more money for meeting deadlines didn't work. But that doesn't mean that beating the writer with the stick of a salary deduction would appeal to him either. 2. I know what they know. The days when managers know how to do every job in the company better than anyone else are over. The reason Peter Drucker said that the manager of the future will know how to ask rather than how to tell is because Drucker understood that knowledge workers would know more than any manager does. Well, the future is here with a vengeance. And smart managers need to shed the overconfident bias that they know as much as their employees know in specific areas. It's a blind spot that diminishes their employees' abilities and enthusiasm and ultimately shrinks the boss's stature. 3. I hate selfishness. How many times has an employee come to you complaining that he or she isn't happy or fulfilled in a job, and the initial thought balloon hanging over your head is, "Quit griping, you selfish ope. I pay you a lot of money to do a job, not to be happy. Get back to work." How many times has an employee come to you with an outside job offer, hoping that you will counter the offer because he or she doesn't want to leave you or the company, and your initial response is to question the employee's loyalty, to regard him or her as an ingrate and traitor? I contend that these crude Neanderthal responses are instances of prejudice too. And it's easy to see why managers feel this way. They have decades of bias training on their side. Historically, large U.S. companies have benefited from a one-sided proposition. While the company was supposed to maximize return for itself and shareholders, the individual was expected to discount his or her self-interests and focus on the good of the company. It was considered outrageous for employees to openly demand, "What's in it for me?" I hope we can all agree that in the new world order, where the organization man has been replaced by the highly mobile free agent, no manager should be taken aback by employees who are looking out for themselves. You certainly shouldn't resent them for it or brand them as selfish. Actually, you should embrace it, because it's a relatively easy problem to handle if you can beat the employees to the punch. A talent agent once told me about an eye-opening encounter he had with Jack Welch when he was chairman of General Electric. The agent's firm had just concluded a long-term contract renewal with an eye-popping raise and stock options for an on-air broadcaster at GE's NBC broadcasting unit. Welch mentioned the broadcaster's name in the meeting, and the agent half-proudly, half-sheepishly said, "Yes, I'm afraid we took you guys to the cleaners with that one." Welch's eyes flared for a second, and the agent feared that he had needlessly insulted the legendary CEO. In solemn, serious tones, Welch said, "You don't understand. You don't hose us. We wanted to give him the money. We would have done anything to keep him happy." Let that be your model for dealing with needy, demanding, allegedly selfish employees. To ignore them and resent them is to misunderstand them and eventually lose them. You're committing the corporate equivalent of a hate crime. 4. I can always get someone else. In the past, the key to wealth may have been control of land, materials, plants, and tools. In that environment, the worker needed the company more than the company needed the worker. Today, the key to wealth is knowledge. As a result, the company needs the knowledge worker far more than the knowledge worker needs him. To make matters worse, the workers know this. They see themselves as fungible assets, no longer at the mercy of company whim, rather than dispensable commodities. The difference is subtle but real. As a fungible asset, the free agent sees himself as always getting a better job somewhere else. If he were merely a commodity, anyone could replace him, which we know is not true anymore. Managers at smart companies are catching on. They're beginning to see that their relationship with top talent resembles a strategic alliance rather than a traditional employment contract. They know free agents can leave any time. When I polled the top 120 executives at one of the world's leading high-tech companies, can the highest potential leader who works for you leave the company and get another job with the pay raise in 1 week? All 120 executives said yes. I'm sure this was the managerial prejudice at play when the Orlando Magic let Shaquille O'Neal slip out of their hands in 1995 and go off to the Los Angeles Lakers. This is like Microsoft letting Bill Gates go elsewhere, or Sony Music letting Bruce Springsteen slip away from their recording label. Some talent is not replaceable. Sure, Shaq was expensive to keep, but Orlando must have thought he was replaceable, that they could spend the money to buy another player just like him. That's a costly prejudice. The facts are that Orlando turned into a second-tier team when O'Neal left, and the Lakers won 3 world championships soon after he arrived. I cite sports examples here because the information is public and readily available, not because it's free agent behavior at its most extreme. Believe me, this same extreme, what's in it for me attitude, goes on thousands of times a day in companies across America. People unhappy, people running off resumes at Kinko's, people testing the job market, people leaving good jobs for better ones, all because their bosses were blind to the real reasons they came to work each day. If that blindness isn't prejudice, I don't know what else to call it. But it's happening. The only difference is we don't read about each individual case in the newspaper. If none of these examples hits home yet, let me hit you where it can really hurt. If you continue to harbor these prejudices and ignore the changing realities in your workplace, it can cost you your job. It can cost you your job even if you're the top dog and are putting up great numbers. I'm not saying that managers have been completely stripped of their authority. In most cases, the top-down chain of command structure is still intact. People still obey their boss's commands, but there's been a subtle shift in power in the workplace, and some of it now resides in the free agents. More of it than managers imagine. That's one reason I have a job. When I work one-on-one with a manager, it's often because he or she has done something to tick off his direct reports. Some are so annoyed that they leave the company. In effect, the departing employees are voting with their feet. At some point, if enough of them cast similar votes, the free agent worker's response to the manager registers as a serious problem. That's when I get called in to find out what's annoying the employees, share that with the boss, and get him to change his ways. Casey Stengel liked to point out that on any baseball team, 1/3 of the players loved the manager, 1/3 hated him, and 1/3 were undecided. The secret to managing a ball club, said Stengel, was to keep the third you hated from getting together with the third who were undecided. That's the real peril today in free agent nation. One employee can't bring a good manager down, but a bunch of employees can gang up and topple even the most productive bosses. Remember this as you gently or brutally navigate your way through the ever-shifting management landscape of free agent nation. Take a temperature reading on your prejudices from time to time. Are you responding to your employees with outdated biases? Or are you meeting the new free agent mindset on its own terms? In the context of this book, accepting the new terrain can make you a more successful boss and quite possibly save your job. Your people are changing constantly, and it's right in front of your eyes. If you don't change accordingly, you may as well be managing with your eyes wide shut. That's the most unforgivable prejudice of all. Stop trying to coach people who shouldn't be coached. In the same way that some of your problems do not need fixing because they are an issue to only a small minority of people, as a boss, you should stop trying to change people who don't want to change. This may sound harsh, but some people are unsalvageable. You're only banging your head against a wall if you think you can fix them. Believe me, I know. It's taken me years to appreciate that some problems are so deep and systematic and strange that they are impervious to my particular ministrations. Through trial and error, I have shed all illusions about my methods and concluded that some flaws can't be coached away by any boss, especially with the following employees. Stop trying to change people who don't think they have a problem. Have you ever attempted to change the behavior of a successful adult at work who has no interest in changing? How much luck have you had with this conversion activity? The answer is always the same. No luck. Now bring it closer to home. Have you had any luck trying to change a spouse, partner, or significant other who has no interest in changing? Again, same answer. My mother went to college for 2 years and was a superb, much admired first grade teacher. She was so dedicated that she saw no line of demarcation between how she behaved in the classroom and in the real world. She talked to everyone with the same slow, patient cadence and simple vocabulary that she employed with her six-year-olds each day. Mom lived in a world entirely populated by first graders. I was always a first grader. Her siblings were always in the first grade. All our relatives were in the first grade. My father was in the first grade. Mom was always correcting everyone's grammar. One day, she was correcting my father for the 10,000th time. He looked at her, sighed, and said, "Honey, I'm 70 years old. Let it go." If your people don't care about changing, don't waste your time. Stop trying to change people who are pursuing the wrong strategy for the organization. If you're going in the wrong direction, all you'll do is help them get there faster. Stop trying to change people who should not be in their job. Some people feel they're in the wrong job at the company. Perhaps they believe that they were meant to be doing something else, or that their skills are being misused, or that they are missing something. If you have any sensitivity, you have a good idea who these people are. Even if you pick up only a tiny molecule of this vibe, ask them, "What if we shut down today?" Would you be surprised, sad, or relieved? More often than not, they will choose relieved. Take that as your cue to send them packing. You can't change the behavior of unhappy people so that they become happy. You can only fix the behavior that's making the people around them unhappy. Finally, stop trying to help people who think everyone else is the problem. I once dealt with an entrepreneur who, after a few high-profile employee departures, was concerned about employee morale. He ran a dominant company in a fun business. People loved working there, but the feedback said the boss played favorites in the way he compensated people. Some employees were handsomely paid. Others got whatever he thought he could get away with. The only way to get a big raise was to put a gun to his head, i.e., threaten to quit and mean it. When I reported this back to the entrepreneur, he surprised me by agreeing with the charge and defending it. Like many self-made men, he regarded every nickel he paid an employee as a nickel that didn't go into his pocket. He paid people according to a Darwinian scale of what he thought they were worth in the marketplace. If they could get more elsewhere, they'd have to prove it to him first. I'm not a compensation strategist. I wasn't equipped to solve this problem. But he had another surprise in store for me. It turned out that the entrepreneur hadn't called me to help him change. He wanted me to fix the employees. In moments like this, I tend to run, not walk away. It's hard to help people who don't think they have a problem. It's impossible to fix people who think someone else is the problem. You should too. People like this will never give up their near religious belief that any failure is someone else's fault. They hold this belief as firmly as if it were their religion. Trying to convert them would be like trying to convert an ardent Democrat into a Republican, or vice versa. Not gonna happen. So save time and skip the heroic measures. This is an argument you will never win. Coda, you are here now. Take a breath. Take a deeper breath. Imagine that you're 95 years old and ready to die. Before taking your last breath, you're given a great gift. The ability to travel back in time. The ability to talk to the person who is reading this page. The ability to help this person be a better professional and lead a better life. The 95-year-old who understands what was really important and what wasn't, what mattered and what didn't. What advice would this wise, old you have for the you who is reading this page? Take your time and answer the question on two levels, personal advice and professional advice. Jot down a few words that capture what the old you would be saying to the younger you. Once you've written these words down, the rest is simple. Just do whatever you wrote down. Make it your resolution for the rest of the current year and the next. You have just defined your there. I cannot define there for you. I cannot dictate it, and I'm certainly not going to judge it as being worthy or noble. To do so would not only be presumptuous, it's none of my business. But I can make a rough prediction about what some features of your there will look like. Because a friend of mine actually had the opportunity to interview people who were dying and ask them what advice they would have had for themselves. The answers he got were filled with wisdom. One reoccurring theme was to reflect upon life, to find happiness and meaning now, not next month or next year. The great Western disease lies in the phrase, I will be happy when, as in, I will be happy when I get that promotion, or I will be happy when I buy that house, or I will be happy when I get that money. The wise old you has finally realized that the next promotion, the next achievement, the next move to a larger house or a more attractive corner office won't really change your world that much. Many older people say they were so wrapped up in looking for what they didn't have that they seldom appreciated what they did have. They often wish they would have taken more time to enjoy it. A second reoccurring theme was friends and family. Consider this. You may work for a wonderful company, and you may think that your contribution to that organization is very important. When you are 95 years old and you look at the people around your deathbed, very few of your fellow employees will be there waving goodbye. Your friends and family will probably be the only people who care. Appreciate them now and share a large part of your life with them. Yet another reoccurring theme was the reflection to follow your dreams. Older people who have tried to achieve their dreams are always happier with their lives. Figure out your true purpose in life and go for it. This doesn't apply to just big dreams. It also is true for little dreams. Buy the sports car you always wanted. Go to that exotic locale that's always held your fascination. Learn how to play the piano or speak Italian. If some people think your vision of a well-lived life is a bit goofy or offbeat, who cares? It isn't their life. It's yours. Few of us will achieve all of our dreams. Some dreams will always elude us. So the key question is not, did I make all my dreams come true? The key question is, did I try? I conducted a research project for Accenture involving more than 200 high-potential leaders from 120 companies around the world. Each company could nominate only two future leaders, the very brightest of its young stars. These are the kinds of people who could jump at a moment's notice to better paying positions elsewhere. We asked each of these young stars a simple question. If you stay in this company, why are you going to stay? The three top answers were, 1. I am finding meaning and happiness now. The work is exciting, and I love what I am doing. 2. I like the people. They are like my friends. This feels like a team. It feels like a family. I could make more money working with other people, but I don't want to leave the people here. 3. I can follow my dreams. The organization is giving me a chance to do what I really want to do in life. The answers were never about money. They were always about happiness, relationships, following dreams, and meaning. When my friend asked people on their deathbeds what was important to them, they gave exactly the same answers as the high-potential leaders I interviewed. Use that wisdom now. Don't look ahead. Look behind. Look back from your old age at the life you hope to live. Know that you need to be happy now, to enjoy your friends and family, to follow your dreams. You are here. You can get there. Let the journey begin. This has been What Got You Here Won't Get You There. How Successful People Become Even More Successful. Written by Marshall Goldsmith and Mark Ryder. Narrated by Jared Vanderbeck. Copyright 2007 by Marshall Goldsmith. Production copyright by Marshall Goldsmith.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.